Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, if this is when you're listening to this. This is Sarah Fowler. I am at the Green Antler after a long absence, so I'm back at home in Tassus, British Columbia. The last episode we did, season two, episode one, I recorded in Gananoque. I was able to visit there for a few days in Ontario. I was in Ontario for quite some time, but now I'm back in British Columbia. And in Tassus, I have a few sort of housekeeping announcements, just something that I'm working on for my own schedule, I suppose. But submitted respectfully wanted the Art of Engagement participating. We want to recruit new members for the Parents Advisory Committee, the PAC at Captain Mears Elementary. I know we're trying to have a meeting next Tuesday for that, which is also the school trustee meeting after the Thanksgiving weekend. I'm also seeking letters of support or letters of interest for my TAC committee, the Tassus Age Friendly Action Committee, Accessibility Action Committee. So if you're interested in sitting on this committee, hopefully we can connect with the seniors center about someone they might recommend, and we can move forward with the next phase for that committee. In addition to having elections for the PAC, for the Parents Association, we're also having elections for the U4C, that's the Unity Trail. We'll have to have that before the end of the year, and also for the Nootka Sound Watershed Society. So there's a lot of calls for engagement, and I'm interested in this CanWill initiative, which is put out by the FCM, just trying to recruit more volunteers and participants for these committees' elections for the Christmas hamper delivery for the Knights of Columbus, or the cupboard, the community cupboard that William Davidson has been working on in my absence. And so I hope to get involved with that now that I'm back home. And with that, I'm going to say welcome to season two, episode two. This is Sarah Fowler. Sarah Waterfowl Fowler. And in last episode, we read a book which was about polar bears. So there's a little story here about what was happening at the Green Antler at the same time. There was a dead bear in the yard. And so that was where I was at mentally, thinking about, wow, okay, coming back home. You know, it took three live strong men to drag this dead bear. So that's something that I'm thinking about. And I'm going to read a bit of the book that I produced here at the Green Antler in 2019, Tassus Revival Anthology. It's the SMF Fowler and Green Antler's Heartworks team. So this is the Inlet Outlet, the second edition. And I think I'm going to read, let's see, the first one that comes to my, oh, let's see, maybe I'll read, oh, Fool's Mate, A Christmas Candle. Both of those I've read in my Facebook Live, and I'm almost finding something else. This one, Silent Night, Holy Night, Christmas in the Catacombs. I know which one I want to read for you guys today. It's going to be, oh, Somebody Must Believe in Christmas. One more. I'm so close. There it is, The Case Rests. So this is
Subject, Look Before You Leap, title, In Defense of Old Values. And this is page 106 of the 2019 Tassus Inlet Outlet. You are never too old to learn that he who hesitates is lost, So don't cross that bridge till you come to it. Look before you leap. It is better to be safe than sorry. Familiar words, aren't they? We hear them and use them every day. They are so much a part of our language. Sometimes we use them unconsciously, but mostly we use them as wisecracks, as though we are ashamed of their sentiment. There is many a true word spoken in jest. Maxims and proverbs represent the accumulated wisdom of the ages, taken from the Bible, old age tales, and fables. They have been passed down from generation to generation, and their advice is still practical. In the early settlements on this continent and in the Great Trek West, formal schooling was often an impossibility. So children were educated by liberal applications of scripture and precept. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and in his old age he will not depart from it. Moral standards were very definite, with dire circumstances in store for the offender. Children had a healthy fear of the devil and all his works because they were taught early in life that the wages of sin is death and the way of the transgressor is hard. Honor thy father and thy mother meant respect and obedience. It also meant several trips to the woodshed and the old hickory stick. Grandma's lye soap kept the tongue of Eve from evil and the lips from speaking guile. Have you ever had your mouth washed out with soap? Young people were told that Satan finds work for idle hands to do, and were warned not to look upon the wine when it is red. The reason why was always for your own good. Thrift and industry were necessary components of life in the old days. Our grandparents were told to use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. Waste not, want not. A stitch in time and a penny saved is a penny earned were everyday expressions. A work day was from dawn to dark. By the sweat of thy brow shall thou eat bread. It was early to bed and early to rise, and the laborer was worthy of his hire. Life wasn't exactly a bed of roses, but it wasn't all work and no play. There was always time for neighborliness and a helping hand in times of doubt. Many hands make light work. We remember all these things, but we don't apply them. Our modern way of life is too much with us, and we take the line of least resistance. We spare the rod, we burn the candle at both ends, and the only wages we expect are higher ones. In our affluent society, we buy now and pay later. We discard anything that isn't in fashion. We offer welfare instead of a helping hand. We are employed for 8 hours a day. We have automation instead of perspiration. We are prodigal with time and profligate with money. Perhaps we should reconsider the virtues in the old values. Nothing ventured, nothing won. We could tell our government that actions speak louder than words, and honesty is the best policy. Tell our educators that too many trips to the well will break the pitcher, or too many cooks spoil the broth, or you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Tell our young people where there's smoke, there's fire, and there's safety in numbers. And it wouldn't hurt them to know that fine feathers do not necessarily make fine birds. Handsome is as handsome does. Internationally, we could learn that fools walk in where angels fear to tread. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. pride goeth before fall, and a haughty spirit before destruction. It is better to eat beans and bacon in peace than have cakes and ale in fear. So you see, there is a definite need for the old maxims in our life today. Let's make a conscientious effort to apply them. Perhaps familiarity has bred contempt, and you say, "Oh, I've heard all that before." Of course you have, because it's true. The gods help them to help themselves. The gods help them who help themselves, and virtue is its own reward. Remember, hope springs eternal from the human breast, so look for the silver lining, even if it's always darker before the dawn. There's nothing new under the sun. So if someone can say it's better than you, if someone can say it better than you, give the devil his due. The case rests. That piece is by Irene R. Ward. I.R. Ward, as it's signed here. And that is a person who has really helped shape the anthology as it goes. The first edition from 2018 was sort of inspired by her poem Stumps that I found. I think I'm going to move on to page 2020 of the 2019. No, of I'm going to move on to page 220. This is Karen Zylistra's poem. I don't know if I read it right because of the notation, but I'm going to go through this poem on page 220. Of all the times I held you, it changed me, changed us. Each loss begs, what did I do, not do? Love's forgotten to shifting seas, mind, body, ash. Pains my chest, womb, begs me, change, change, change. Looking for sustenance, sustaining, filling, completing, belonging, ash. If not for you, who? Her, past, her, present, her, future, ash. I don't have an answer. It waits on grief. So that is Karen Zylistra's poem. And here's another on page 227. What is the truth? You pull, I pull, we pull. Like the moon, gravity, tides of body. What is the truth? There are so many. Attraction, projection, reflection. Encyclical. And where shall I go now? Maybe I should go to a Mary Hawkes' story, because that is sort of what all of these anthologies have been for the most part. I don't know which one I like best. The Dump Heap or Fool's Mate. I think I'm going to go with the Dump Heap, because it just seems like the right one. Welcome home to Tassus. So this is again by, this is by Mary Hawkes, and Irene R. Ward was her literary heir who inherited her written works. And I am also the literary heir of these writing ladies, Vancouver Island writing ladies. So, The Dump Heap by Mary Hawkes. The dump heap sprawled like a wart on the prairie's aged face, which had endured worse insults in its 140 million years. A lovely specimen of humanity gloating over his discovery was not interested in geology, but in the more immediate question of his own survival. The dump heap, plus its suburb location, offered the solution. To the ill-informed, the prairie suggested a vast, treeless plain with ever-receding horizons, scorching summers with alarming thunderstorms, desolate winters where the naked winds whiplash the luckless traveler and blizzards lie in wait for the unwary. But the prairie has an engaging habit of springing her own surprises. Here and there, she produces a charming lake protected by poplars and willows, and on the indefinable line where brush and prairie meet, the more enduring conifers. In such an oasis stood Humpy, thoughtful, turning over the debris with battered but sturdy boots that had borne him courtesy from the CPR freight 200 miles from his winter hibernation in Saskatoon. An insensitive orphanage superintendent had registered unclaimed foundlings in alphabetical order, had named him Humphrey Hudson. Inevitably, it had degenerated into Humpy. Horrible protuberances back and front isolated him from his kind. Attendants handed him unconsciously and distastefully, secretly wondering why nature, who perturbed this monstrous joke, endowed her victim with such unnecessary vitality. And thrive he did for 5 years, when fate momentarily relented and sent a childless couple in search of a son. But the exacting standards of the adopting center, the carpenters scarcely qualified. They were elderly, and their financial position as small storekeepers shaky. But when Mrs. Carpenter gathered the forlorn hunchback in her arms, saying simply, "I want him," authority, astonished and relieved, made no objections. "But why," remonstrated her husband, "when there are so many lovely children to choose from?" "He's lovely," said his wife. "Look at his great brown eyes, and he has a beautiful head. Looks like the statue of David carved by some Italian fellow. I shall call him David." And she did, but David still thought of himself as Humpy. When he was 6, he went to school. "He must face the world sooner or later," said his foster father. But when he came home on 3 successive days weeping, and on the 4th was reported missing and found cowering in a woodshed, his mother said firmly, "He'll face the world later. He's too little now. I'll teach him myself, and you can go square the school inspector." For 20 years, Humpy lived a comparatively happy life. He made no friends, but the neighborhood gradually accepted him, and he became indifferent to the occasional shout of, "Hi, Humpy," and only shrank a little more into himself when the superstitious touched him for luck. But when the old people were simultaneously carried off in the flu epidemic, it was found that the business, hard-pressed by this new supermarket, was practically bankrupt. Humpy sold out, buried the only friends he had in the world, paid off their debts, and faced life with $15.75. Finding work was a problem. His deformed bones, pressing too tightly into his chest, produced emphysema, which made breathing difficult and physical exertion a torture. His neck became constricted, and his heavy head, whose classical outlines had once been admired, was forced towards his chest, giving him a hangdog sinister aspect. His education was too sketchy for a simple clerical job, and finally he made a permanent welfare case. That suited him well. For a few dollars a month, he found himself an accommodation address where he could fetch his monthly check, and though somewhat hard-pressed during the first long winter, he found that by taking to the road in summer, he could save enough to make the succeeding winter tolerable, at least financially, since neither dope nor drink attracted him. He might have lived in town contentedly enough, taking in the occasional movie and attending the friendly, boisterous Salvation Army meetings, where at least he was regarded as a man, not a freak, had it not been for the girls. They'd haunted his dreams, in which he was handsome, and they were kind, and like Caliban, When he walked, he circled. He cried to dream again. When he waked, he cried to dream again. By day, pretty girls glanced at him with disgust or pity, passing by with averted heads, and he lived on his own private hell. By nature, he was not a violent man, but sometimes he was afraid of himself, and he knew that withdrawal from the world was his only answer. Hence his delight in the dump heap, which could become a permanent home. It was no longer used, and there were no marks of wagon wheels or car tires. The 7 years of drought followed by mechanizing had resulted in the abandoning of small farms. The nearest house was 2 miles distant, was uninhabited. He had discovered by careful observation by one old lady who suggested to his experienced eye a sedentary character unlikely to venture far abroad. The dump heap provided most of the necessities of life. Right against a shelter of tangled willow was an old Model T, its curtains still intact, a ready-made house still reasonably weatherproof. A rusty stove yielded a perfectly good rack, and someone had extravagantly tossed out a few bricks. Here was a perfect fireplace. A stained mattress sweetened by the sun and wind would serve in the car for really inclement weather, though even at 10 below, Humpy preferred to sleep on the ground previously warmed by the fire. If there were fir branches available for a springy mattress, that was real luxury. There were discarded kettles and pans in abundance, needing nothing more than a few mendits or a touch of soldering iron. The coils of wire would be handy for snaring rabbits. A lantern needed new parts, which could probably be picked up at a junk shop next time he visited the city. In summer, like the birds, he rose and slept with the sun. He had a hunting knife and a hatchet. There was fuel in plenty and fresh water. What more did he need? So here Humpy happily settled. He was fortunately situated not more than 10 miles from town, and here he fixed himself with another accommodation addressed to placate welfare officials, and once a month collected his check and a gunny sack of provisions. For company, he had a multitude of songbirds by day. He learned to distinguish them by sight and sound, and tamed Whiskey Jacks and friendly chipmunks to eat out of his hand. At night, owls and night jays talked companionably, and he soon learned that there were no menace in the howling of the coyotes and the maniacal laugh of the loon. The lake was well stocked with fish, ducks, and grebe, and he constructed himself a raft from which he fished successfully with a homemade contraption and occasionally helped himself to a few duck eggs. Life was good, and as the forecast was for a milder winter, he decided to stay rather than risk the city with its disturbing girls. Mrs. Sharp, the old lady who knew all about her neighboring squatter, was annoyed, but not with him. Her flighty daughter-in-law, Bella, had persuaded a docile husband to take her to Hawaii for Christmas and had dumped their 8-year-old Henry on his less-than-doting grandmother. "I know you'll adore to have him," Bella gushed. "We've brought mountains of presents for him to open at Christmas Day, and when we come back, we'll give him a real party. He'll be real company for you. I can't bear to think of you all alone at Christmas." The members of the Ladies' Aid, whose work parties Mrs. Sharp faithfully attended, adopted the same regrettable attitudes. "How lovely for you," they trilled variously. "Ha!" snorted Mrs. Sharp. "It's a case of glad to see him come and glad to see him go. And I'm not exactly glad to see come." They plant themselves uninvited for a meal, go off, and leave me with the dishes and their kid without so much of a by your leave. I never did hold with grandmothers being unpaid babysitters. He's a good enough lad, but I'll ask you, what am I going to do with him? And not another child within miles of him. Mrs. Sharp did her conscientious best to her grandson, but no, she brought out some of his father's old books and toys. Then struck with remorse when she saw how listlessly he'd played with them, suggested briskly, "Come on, we'll get ourselves a Christmas tree, same as your father and your Aunt Maud always did with their father on Christmas Eve. There's not too many about, but there's a few by the lake a couple miles away that's not many knows about, and I ain't telling." Henry's interest revived slightly at the sight of the dump and an odd-looking figure crouching over a fire. His grandmother explained, "I did tell you there's been some sort of squatter living here, but he never does me no harm, and live and let live is my motto. Hey, mister, can you spare us one of your trees? They happen to be mine." She chuckled, "But seeing as you're by way of being my tenant, how about cutting one for the rent?" Humpy met the twinkling gray eyes with the smile that had long ago captivated Mrs. Carpenter. "I reckon that's fair enough," he said. "Give us the axe and I'll find you a good one and hike it back to you too. If you's wait a minute, I'll make a willow whistle for the young'un." Harry accepted the gift with delight, gazing at the strange figure with frank curiosity, but with no trace of aversion or pity. "You know," he confided with the awful frankness of children, "my father's a doctor and you are like a picture of one of his books. It says grotesque figures, and I think you are very interesting." "Harry, mind your manners," protested his grandmother sharply, but Humpy was pleased. "Thank you, lad. That's the first time anyone had told me I'm interesting." As they lugged the tree home, Harry chattered happily, inquiring closely concerning his new friend's way of life and becoming obviously enchanted with him. Hesitatingly, Mrs. Sharp asked, "Would you step in and have a bite with us?" But Humpy thanked her and melted into the dusk. Feeling quite cheerful, Mrs. Sharp extricated from the cupboard some long-forgotten Christmas tree decorations, recounting the history of each one, from the star at the apex to the delicately filigreed creche at the base. When the newfangled electric lights were turned on, she stepped back with satisfaction. "That's real pretty. I'm right glad you're here, Harry lad." But Harry, who had become increasingly silent as the work progressed, uttered a sound between a scream and a sob, yanked at the tree with all his force and stamped on the glittering ornaments. "Harry," screamed his outraged grandmother, "you wicked boy, go to your room at once." Harry fled. For a few minutes, she was busy righting the tree, salvaging the wreck of her cherished trivia, sobbing with grief and rage. She was not a drinking woman, but kept brandy for strictly medicinal purposes. This, she was grimly certain, was the right medicine at the right time. "Luckily, the little devil didn't find these," she muttered as she took one of her grandfather's priceless old glasses and lovingly warmed it and its precious contents in the palm of her hand as he had taught her. As the liquor comforted and steadied her, she, being a fair-minded woman, began to wonder at her well-behaved grandson's little inexplicable outburst. Slowly, enlightenment came. "You're a dern old fool," she told herself crossly, yammering to the child about his dad at Christmas and him breaking his heart for his own folk. I'd best go to see what I can do." But Harry was not in his room. Terrified at the enormity of his crime, he fled blindly out into the moonlit snow, his feet finding the trail as instinctively as the hunted hare, till he fell in a gasping heap over over the dump heap. Humpy asked no questions. He cradled the sobbing child in his arms, felt with wonder the fair head cushioned on the hump that was his breast, and was infinitely content. When Harry finally stammered out his sad little confession, Humpy commented acidly, "You're a right silly lad. Ought to be glad you got a father and mother coming back to give you a party, and a grandmother that takes trouble for you. Now is going home." "No, no," wailed Harry. "She'll be so mad at me." "Ought to be glad you got someone to be mad at you. Us is going back. You's going to tell your grandmother you sorry and take what's coming to you. And tomorrow, if she'll let you come back here, us'll have rabbit stew." It was a frantic woman who hugged her errant grandson, and in the midst of mutual apologies and healing tears, Humpy disappeared. On Christmas morning, Humpy had two guests to share his rabbit stew. Mrs. Sharp did not thank him. She bade him authoritatively to Christmas dinner that night, and he came. As they sat replete before a comfortable fireplace, Harry's drowsy head found the accustomed place on Humpy's misshapen breast. Mrs. Sharp murmured tentatively, "I could do with a man around the place, especially in winter. Too many chores for an old woman. I don't often have company, but if you were so minded, you could always slip into that hidey hole of yours. Though, if you ask me, which you don't, you got to face the world sooner or later. That's what me dad said quite some time ago," aloud Humpy. "And my mum said I was too little, but I guess I ain't so little now." "Well," demanded the old lady. "Maybe," Humpy said cautiously. "I'm groaned enough now. Growed enough now." So that was page 60 of the 2019 Inlet Outlet, and that was called The Dump Heap. And I guess I can go into The 100 Sheep as we're coming on to 30 minutes of this podcast, and this is on page 28. So, The 100 Sheep by Mary Hawkes. There were 99 that safely lay in the shelter of the fold, caroled sister Agnes blithely, and was checked by the resigned voice of her superior sister Agnes. Sister Agnes, oblivious, continued, but with less assurance. But one was out on the hills away, far off from the gates of gold. "Sister Agnes," in sharper tones. "Yes, mother." The singer could no longer feign deafness, but defiantly continued. "Away on the mountains, cold and bare, away from the tender shepherd's care," as she industriously polished windows. Mother Lenore, who had been vainly attempting to check accounts, which never balanced, sighed. "Don't you know any other hymns?" "Of course. But this one fits the circumstance so exactly." "What circumstances?" asked Mother Lenore suspiciously. "And don't look so innocent. That means you're planning some foolishness." "Foolishness?" protested Sister Agnes indignantly. "Is it foolish to seek a lost lamb?" "Oh, no," groaned Mother Lenore, "not vanity again." Sister Agnes, ever the optimist, in spite of repeated failures, defended her protégés valiantly. "There's nothing wrong with vanity, except that she can't say no, and doesn't that imply a certain generosity? She's not a prostitute. She doesn't sell herself for money. She just likes to give pleasure, and no doubt receive it," commented Mother Lenore dryly. "Anyway," continued Sister Agnes triumphantly, "she's coming to the retreat." "You're crazy, Agnes, and you're a defeatist." "And you're a defeatist, Lenore," retorted the other, both forgetting for a moment the formalities and reverting to their school days. when the bouncing blonde blue-eyed Agnes and the dark reserved Lenore had formed a lifelong friendship. But from which conversation it could be gathered that the Order of the Sisters of Joy was somewhat unconventional. Its members eschewed convent garb, only a silver cross giving any hint of dedicated lives. Each was bound by the usual vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience, but under Mother Lenore's benevolent regime, the last was seldom enforced. She was regarded very definitely as first among equals, and self-discipline was expected rather than imposed. A wealthy woman in her own right, conscious of her vocation but chafing under the rigid discipline of traditional orders, she had succeeded with the help of the modern-oriented bishop in establishing a liberal community, which was eyed somewhat dubiously by the strictly orthodox. Even the bishop was perturbed when asked for the seal of approval for the Sisters of Joy. "Do you really realize there's a prostitute guild called the Daughters of Joy?" Mother Lenore smiled. "I know, that's why I chose the name, to demonstrate that nuns can be joyous as well as holy. Such discipline, as well as was maintained, was due mostly to the influence of the senior members of the new order. Sister Beatrice, she had been young Lenore's novice mistress and had become regrettably attached to the irreverent youngsters. Personal friendships were not encouraged for the Brides of Christ. When Lenore possessed enough wealth and influence to found her own order, Sister Beatrice joined in loving disapproval, unsurprised that lifelong commitments was no longer required. Vows were renewed every 2 years, and no stigma attached to those who decided they had mistaken their vocation. Instead, a farewell party was given with best wishes for another form of service to God and humanity. Sister Beatrice clung to the traditional habit and could be depended upon to observe the daily devotions from prime to nuns. The rest, no less devout, slipping in and out when momentarily freed from various tasks, visiting the sick, scourging the distressed, or escorting a mob of excited youngsters to the circus. All except Sister Beatrice drove cars, spent occasional weekends with family or friends, even indulging in the evening of dance or theater, and retiring with new zest to their chosen work. But each knew in her own heart that it was Sister Beatrice's stern, unbending probity that kept the balance true in this relaxed community. The news that Vanity had been cajoled into attending a retreat was greeted with universal skepticism, and even by Sister Agnes, though she would not confess it, with secret misgivings. How Vanity came to her name no one knew, least of all herself. She was registered Vanessa, which by some secret alchemy had been transmuted to Vanity, which exactly suited her gay and irresponsible disposition. Affectionate and generous, she danced her way lightheartedly through life with, as police records testified, no visible means of support. She had no need to walk the streets or solicit, she was just there. Sometimes she even took a job for a few weeks as a waitress, where she charmed the young blades with her pert witticisms and the old and infirm with kindly consideration. Sister Agnes loved the wayward girl and labored incessantly to transform her into a respectable member of society with a steady job and assured income. "Might as well try to capture a hummingbird," Sister Beatrice commented acidly, but Sister Agnes was happy now and more confident of success. She felt that she had at least got through to the peanut brain.
Her argument that youth and beauty do not last forever and, what then, had made a lasting impression. Vanity momentarily assailed by fleeting versions of the loveless old age, and fancies herself as a possible saintly Saint Teresa, agreed at last to give it a whirl. Conversation is allowed on the first evening of the retreat, and Vanity prattled happily at supper, basking in the attention she received. At Vespers, she delighted the worshippers just before benediction by singing a prearranged by the conductor, Sister Agnes's favorite hymn, There Were 99. Even Sister Beatrice was moved by the untrained but beautiful soprano and the expression of pure devotion on the flower-like face. Probably sees herself as a chorister, the old nun muttered sardonically, but Sister Agnes's innocent heart beat high with hope. Vanity was disappointed. No one clapped, and when Sister Agnes silently but affectionately led her to her solitary cell, she gazed apprehensively at its bleak contents, a bed, a chair, and a crucifix. Under the sister's indulgent eye, she hastily unpacked her expensive suitcase, far too costly even to her friend's unworthy eyes, and extracted a gaudy doll, a bunch of plastic roses, a comic book, and a ravishing nightgown that she felt really brightened up the horrible room a bit. Sister Agnes kissed her forehead and tiptoed away, a backward glance assuring her that Vanity was actually kneeling in prayer. Everything she felt would be all right. The lost lamb had been found. But Vanity had never in her life slept alone in a room, more often curled up with a companion of either sex, but always some warm and comforting arms around her. She genuinely loved Sister Agnes and hated to disappoint her. She recited the Paternoster twice and Hail Mary three times. As a last recourse, she imagined herself a weeping penitent, kneeling in the dimly lit confessional and exquisite mortification, repeating the sonorous formula, I confess to God the Father, to Saint Michael, and all the holy angels, and before the holy company of heaven, and I have sinned in thought, word, and deed, by my fault, by my own most grievous fault. Fair, beautiful, touching in her abasement, surely Father Baum would not be too hard on her. But the silence, the chill, and the darkness grew more oppressive. Finding no solace in pious thought, she reached for the light's switch. She would read a bit and smoke an illicit cigarette to calm her nerves. For a few blissful moments, she smoked contentedly, inhaling deeply. I'll make it, she resolved. What's a couple of days? It'll really please the old girl, and she's been good to me. Then, without warning, the electricity was shut off. No one had thought to warn her that the interest of economy, this was mandatory at 10:30 p.m. It was just too much. Vanity screamed and screamed again. Let me out of here. Let me out. I'm going mad in here. She had not had the foresight to bring a flashlight, but others had. A battery of lights twinkling like fireflies focused on the terrified girl as she stumbled in her regrettable nightgown down the corridor, fleeing imaginary terror. Heads, some disheveled, some primly encased in curlers, peered at the extraordinary spectacle, startled, horrified, some frankly amused, until one compassionate onlooker threw a protective arm around the frantic fugitive, murmuring soothingly, There, there, it's all right. Someone also called, Get Father Baum, but already the conductor, contriving somehow to look clerical in his rusty gray robe and sandals, took Vanity, whose screams had subsided, into gurgling sobs and led her gently away. Well, exclaimed a shocked voice, I'd been to 10 retreats and never heard silence broken before. Then the speaker clamped her hand over her mouth in dismay. Heads withdrawn, doors closed, but something suspiciously like giggles erupted now and then, and it was not at Vanity that the laughter was directed. Father, did you "What did you do with Vanity?" asked Mother Lenora the next morning. "Took her home. Took her to the home for distressed women." "Oh, Father," Sister Agnes cried, the ready tears filling her prominent blue eyes. "She'll be so unhappy there," the priest smiled. "It will be the good sisters who will be unhappy, I fear." But contrary to expectations, Vanity adapted enthusiastically to her new life, for many distressed women were often accompanied by unauthorized babies. Deserted babies were also cared for until permanent or foster homes could be found, and occasionally babies whose people were temporarily unable to cope. Vanity loved babies and handled them so expertly that the good sisters thought that here at last she had found her true vocation. Particularly, she doted on Johnny Parsons, 6 months old, who decided that Vanity was his particular property. His happy gurgles in her arms and wrathful screams whenever anyone else ventured to pick him up decided the issue. Johnny was no unwanted baby. His mother had died in childbirth. The distraught father, a decent working man, had placed him in the home until he could find a housekeeper. Every evening he visited his son, always to find in Vanity's arms. Finally, the mother superior ordered Vanity to keep away between the hours of 6 and 7 to give the young man a chance to become acquainted with his son. But Johnny would not be comforted, refused to recognize the bearded stranger, so at length the latter conceded, I gotta have both. How about it, Vanity? Why not? Said Vanity demurely. You'll see, said the triumphant Sister Agnes. If it had not been for the retreat, this would have never happened. And happily hummed the finale of her favorite hymn. There arose a cry from the gates of heaven, rejoice, I have found my sheep. But how long before the sheep strays again, questioned one of the sisters. None of them said it aloud to Sister Agnes. 3 months later, a wild-eyed young man stormed into the abode of the Sisters of Joy. Vanity, she's gone. I knew she didn't set much store by me, but I never thought she'd leave the kid. Did she leave a note? Asked the ever-practical sister Beatrice. Yes, here, read it. Vanity's unformed scrawl was difficult to decipher, but its meaning was clear. You didn't want me. You just wanted Johnny. A marriage of convenience is not for me. She never could spell. Sister Agnes. I don't care, cried Jim. We've got to find her. It's not what she says, but I was too blamed a fool to see it. I thought she just wanted the kid. I must go, cried Sister Agnes. I must go and find her. No, not you. For once, Mother Lenora was firm and decisive. Sister Beatrice will accompany you, Jim. Her habit will protect her and lend her authority. For 3 nights, they sought her, starting with the more respectable dance halls until they reached the lowest dives. In one of these, they found her dancing naked on a table to the applause of a drunken crowd. At the sight of the somber figure of Sister Beatrice, majestic in robes of honor representing the might and mystery of a church which had for nearly 2,000 years dominated the minds of man, a great hush fell over the noisy hall. Instinctively, men drew back, leaving the two visitors isolated. Vanity, with a little shriek, covered her face and collapsed on the table. Jim, oblivious to the staring onlookers, towered over her, shook her and growled, "Get your clothes on, girl, and come home where you belong." There was rejoicing along the Sisters of Joy that night, but Sister Agnes never again dared to sing, "There are 99, 90 and 9. I'm not superstitious, she cried to Mother Lenore, but I don't like to tempt Providence. So with that, I think I'll stop there. Maybe I could keep going. There's definitely a lot of other poems in this book. And there's one here. What's this one called? It's another Irene Ward. Oh, this is the one about you have to care about Christmas. Let's see. No, oh, this one's assignment 3, but it starts out, Mary Hawk sat on the side of the highway, her suitcase beside her, an incongruous little figure in that land of rolling sagebrush hills. The smoke of her cigarette curled up undisturbed by the hot, dry air and the bright July sunshine. She felt a twinge of regret for her tree-shaded lawn back on Vancouver Island. At least the weather like this, she wouldn't be plagued by lumbago and have to get home willy-nilly. But she wished she had a cowboy hat. So this was the Caribou Highway. Didn't seem to be much traffic here as there had been on the freeway. She'd been lucky getting rides, except that last one. They had struck up a conversation in the coffee shop at Cache Creek. He looked like a respectable man, and they exchanged points of view quite amicably. Then he discovered she was headed for Prince George and points north and west. He offered her a ride as far as Williams Lake. "I've never met up with a 75-year-old hitchhiker before," he said. As they headed north in his station wagon, "at least not a lady. What's the idea?" "Mostly insatiable curiosity and not enough money to satisfy it properly. This is a big province and I want to see who and what makes it tick." "Well, I can tell you right now that it won't be ticking much longer if those damn unions keep getting a stranglehold on our economy." "Oh, but you have to remember," she remonstrated, "it was the unions that brought better working conditions and fair wages to our workforce. And bankruptcy to the guys like me trying to operate a logging outfit and a mill." He stopped the car and snarled, "No union sympathizers is welcome in my company. Get out." "That was a switch," she mused. "Most people tend to be protective towards her." As she was barely 5 feet tall, topping the scales at 90 pounds with a mop of white hair framing a face stung by the slings and arrows and outrageous fortune, that was not surprising. The lady who had given her a ride as far as Cache Creek was quite horrified at the idea of her hitchhiking. "Whatever can your family be thinking of?" she exclaimed. "At your age, you should be preparing yourself for life in the hereafter. All very well, but if you have to wait 75 years before opportunity knocks, you answer the door very quickly." And besides, her family didn't know what she was up to. The only one who knew and understood was her young friend, Ikey, back home. She philosophically lit another cigarette and wondered how far she would get in the 2 months she had allowed herself. Surely by that time, the pain of Dolly's death would be more bearable and her own guilty feelings less acute. In the midst of her musing, she became aware of a truck stopping and a voice saying, "Hey ma'am, you all right? Something's happened to your car?" "I'm fine, thank you," she said, as she scrambled to her feet and collected her purse and suitcase. "But I sure would like a ride." "Well, I guess it's okay." "How far are you going?" "How far are you going?" "All the way to Hudson's Hope." "Then that's where I'm going. If you'll take me along." With help from the burly driver, she was boosted into the cab with her belongings and settled down for the longest and fastest ride of her life. So that is assignment 3, the story with no title yet, written by Irene Ward, Ikey in the story, about her mentor, Mary Hawks, who is the author of many stories in my Tassus Inlet Outlet Revival Anthology. And with that, I think I'm going to throw a flag and make this the Episode 2, Season 2, Waterfowl Podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope that you find us interesting. You know, we're always looking for new people to write in for our poetry book that we do once a year in December at the end of the year. We're also sort of recruiting a bunch of people for our boards and youth engagement with the Community Cupboard and Knights of Columbus Hampers coming up in November. And as we go forward in Season 2 of The Waterfowl, we're going to try to get some more guests as we had last year. But we're also just going to read books as we like to. So thanks for listening and have a really good day. And, you know, it's good to be home. Bye-bye.